Case number 14-7067, Council of the District of Columbia Appellant versus Vincent C. Gray, Mayor of the District of Columbia, and Jeffrey S. DeWitt, CFO of the District of Columbia. Mr. Netter for the appellant, Mr. Nathan for the appellees.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Brian Netter for the Council.
Good morning.
On the merits, our position is that the charter is amendable unless Congress has expressly provided otherwise. So the primary merits question in this case is whether Congress, in 1973, expressly prohibited the district even from proposing amendments to the district's budget process specified in the charter. And because nothing in the Home Rule Act says that, the Budget Autonomy Act is lawful. The mayor and CFO start from the opposite premise. They assume that the charter is not amendable unless Congress in 1973 would have wanted the amendment in question. But that is not the system that Congress devised in 1973 or that it revised after CHATA in 1984. The best indication of what Congress was doing through the Home Rule Act is, of course, in the text. And the primary provision about which the parties have a dispute in the briefs is Section 603A. And the text of that provision is striking. It is striking because of the disparity, the difference between Section 603A and Section 602A. Section 603A says that nothing in this act shall be construed as making any change in existing law with respect to the budget process, explaining what it was that Congress was doing in 1973 by passing the Home Rule Act.
When Congress Before we go any further on this, can we talk a little bit about jurisdiction?
Absolutely.
Okay. And actually, before we even do that, I have a quick practical question. Is this going to be moot when there's a new mayor and new attorney general?
It won't be for a number of reasons. First is that the CFO is an independent officer. He doesn't turn over with the new election. Second is that the mayor and the attorney general have taken these positions in their official capacities. Those positions, until some future elected official might change that, will remain in force. So we have no indication that this case would become moot in the future.
And would the council have to reaffirm this in January or February after elections as well?
Well, the council's position is on the record. I don't think it would have to reaffirm. I think, again, that the council would have to take action to change its position. But given that the council has unanimously taken the position that it has taken and unanimously authorized litigation, that seems like a remote possibility.
Okay. And then can you talk a little bit about the council's standing?
Yes. As we indicated in the supplemental brief we filed earlier this week, Article 3 is satisfied for three independent reasons. The court's order spoke to legislative or legislator standing. And this case, we believe, is on all fours with the Supreme Court's decision in Coleman, which has been repeatedly left in place both by the Supreme Court and by this court. The injury in that context is the council's authority to pass a budget within 70 days after the mayor's submission of a proposal. Because the mayor promised that he would send the draft budget to the council after 56 days and would represent to the president and to Congress that that was the council's budget, that is an injury much in the vein of the legislators in Coleman, who said that their 20 nay votes against the constitutional amendment ratification were sufficient to defeat that referendum. Alternatively, as against the CFO, because this is a collaborative process between the executive branch of the district government and the council itself, the CFO has various statutory obligations to provide information to the council that the council in turn needs to process and use in order to discharge its statutory obligation to pass a budget. Because the CFO announced that he deemed the Budget Autonomy Act to be void, the council accordingly doesn't have the information that it needs to perform its statutory obligation. And that's a cognizable injury.
Does it have no other authority to obtain that information?
By statute, the CFO is required to provide the fiscal impact statement, and the council is required to review the fiscal impact statement before providing the budget. So the council does not have any other means for obtaining the information that the CFO is required to provide.
Has the mayor actually sent the budget to Congress?
The mayor did so. By the time the budget was passed in April, all the parties were operating under an injunction. So Judge Sullivan enjoined all parties to follow the old budget process, and pursuant to that process, the budget was sent up. This issue continues to be enforced, however, because the council could supplement its budget. We have another fiscal year coming up in which the exact same issues are present. With respect to the other jurisdictional issue in this case, we do believe that this court should direct the district court to remand the case to Superior Court because federal question jurisdiction is lacking under Sections 1331 and 1366. And the key precedent as to this is Diamond versus the District of Columbia, which is in some respects a similar circumstance. In Diamond, this court reviewed a challenge to council legislation that the plaintiff contended violated Section 602A8 of the Charter, which says that the district doesn't have the authority, or the council does not have the authority, to infringe upon the jurisdiction of the U.S. District Court.
In Diamond, all we said is, seems like it's confined to the district, but then went off and found an entirely independent ground for jurisdiction. And all I said was, seems like it applies to the district. But then we have Thomas versus Berry, which seemed to be a very similar situation. It involved transferring power between federal government and local government, and we found that that arose under federal jurisdiction. So how do you address Thomas?
Well, certainly. With respect to Thomas, I think the language of the statutory provision at issue demonstrates why this is different. Section 204G of the Home Rule Act governs the transfer of employees from the federal competitive service to the district government. And it says that any such employee shall retain all the rights, benefits, and privileges pertaining thereto held prior to such transfer. Employees who had been transferred from the Labor Department, from the Federal Labor Department, to the district government filed suit, and the defendants included federal officials saying, we're entitled to our rights under federal law. So there are a couple of distinctions between that case and this one. First of all, the essence of their claim was, what are our rights under federal law? And this is a rather unique provision within the context of the Home Rule Act. And certainly the 602A8, the conclusion that the court came to in Diamond, which I do think is an alternative holding, because
you said it seems. I'm not sure what a holding is that says seems like it applies to the district, but we're going on to this other basis. It's one sentence, seems.
That's correct. In order to find a basis for supplemental jurisdiction, ordinarily a court convinces itself that primary jurisdiction is not available. Mm-hmm. But we also think that Diamond was correct on the merits because Section 602A8, even though it implicates federal officials, is still a provision that applies exclusively to the District of Columbia. Now, the other distinction with the Thomas versus Berry case concerns what constitutes the well-pleaded complaint. In Thomas, it was the plaintiffs who were invoking Section 204G of the Charter and their rights under federal law. Here, the council's well-pleaded complaint contends that the mayor and the CFO were required to discharge their obligations under district law, obligations that apply exclusively to the mayor and to the CFO. Now, the mayor and CFO have come back, and there are certainly federal issues underlying their response, but a federal defense does not entitle them to remove the case to federal court. And accordingly, we think that this dispute among local officials belongs in the local courts pursuant to Section 1366. Now,
so then the standing doesn't even matter to you, legislative standing. You'd be just as happy with the finding that there is no legislative standing because that would mean it should have never been removed to federal court.
That's true. We do think as a matter of law that legislative standing is available here, and we think the precedents clearly support the council's finding of legislative standing. We would think that the court should look at the core subject matter jurisdictional issue first, and because we think there is no subject matter jurisdiction, we think the case should be remanded without this court needing to address the standing issue.
And again, Your injury for purposes of standing, I mean, you're not exactly like Coleman because there they were literally saying something should not have become law. Our votes against it becoming law were nullified. Here you're talking about you passed the law. You passed it. It's on the books. It's just they're not enforcing it the way you would like them to enforce it.
No, well, there's a distinction that I would draw, Your Honor, and that's between the council's injury with respect to the Budget Autonomy Act and the council's injury with respect to the fiscal year 2015 budget. And our analogy to Coleman stems from its relationship to the fiscal year 2015 budget. With respect to that legislation, the mayor asserted that he would represent to the president and to Congress, he would effectively endorse council draft legislation
where if there's going to be a change in personnel, it might make a difference. We don't know how the next mayor is going to deal with these day-by-day steps that you're talking about, even if the mayor were to have the same institutional position. We don't know how that interactive process is going to go forward, do we?
Well, of course, we can't predict the future. That's true. We know as we stand here today that the council had standing when it filed the suit and that the case remains right and has not been mooted by any subsequent action. We don't know what will play out in the future. We have every expectation that this will remain a live claim, in particular because the CFO does not answer to the Attorney General or to the mayor and will remain in office. Accordingly, we think that this issue will remain a live controversy until this court has an opportunity to decide the case. And it is absolutely imperative for the district's purposes that there be an answer by the time the next legislative session, by the time the next budget must be passed through the process that starts in April.
Hasn't the Supreme Court said that if the defendant can bring a coercive action resting on federal question, that's enough to answer your jurisdiction claim on the removal?
Right, so I think that Your Honor is referring to the Franchise Tax Board line of cases. And as we put those cases into effect here, the coercive action, we believe, is the action filed by the council. Because the council sought an injunction directing the mayor and the CFO to discharge their obligations under federal law, this isn't the abstract circumstance in which a party that fears being sued in the future, as with, say, a patent infringement action. It's not that the council preempted reverse litigation. The coercive action is the one that's present here. Also, it's not clear even if the mayor and the CFO had tried to file some sort of a coercive action, what that would have looked like. For example, the Anti-Deficiency Act doesn't have a civil cause of action under which they could have sued the council. But we think that with respect to Franchise Tax Board, this fits in line with the Supreme Court language in that opinion that says that a state is not entitled to get into federal court merely by requesting a declaratory injunction that its law is consistent with federal law. That is, in effect, what this case was when it was filed in Superior Court.
What is the cause of action you sued under?
We sued under the Home Rule Act. That because this was filed in, it's essentially a declaratory judgment provision that is understood to be part of the common law of the Superior Court. That was the cause of action.
A D.C. declaratory judgment action.
That's correct. That's correct. It's a matter of local law.
Okay.
Yeah. On the merits of this case, should this court determine that it should reach the merits, we believe strongly that the district court erred in deeming the Budget Autonomy Act unlawful. And the key determinations here all turn on the text of the applicable statutes.
Congress, I want to ask you about one provision, because I think your theory depends on parsing the budget into two different things, the local portion and the federal portion. But the Home Rule Act defines budget in Title I as the entire request financed from all existing or proposed revenue sources. And 603 carries that forward with this reference to total budget. And so it seems to me that your readings of these depend on a power of the council in amending this law to change what budget means or total budget means.
Well, I don't think so, Your Honor. Total budget continues to mean the exact same thing before and after the budget.
There isn't a total budget that goes through any process. You have changed what the process is for the total budget.
Well, that's correct. And references, the provision that you're referencing is Section 103, which defines budget for purposes of the provisions within the Home Rule Act. And that tells us that when the word budget appears in the Home Rule Act, it means the total budget. And that's true both before the Budget Autonomy Act and afterwards.
And all the processes about budget are referred to as there's a singular term of budget, a single budget act that's referred to in the statute. And now you are, and those are in the amendable and the non-amendable parts of this statute. But the statute, the Budget Autonomy Act, would seem to change what budget means in different parts of the act.
But it would opt not to use that defined term in, for example, Section 446, which is certainly within the authority of the council to use particular language to refer to something. With respect to Section 603, Your Honor's question about the reference to the total budget, that's only meaningful if Section 603A is a future limitation on what the council can do.
I'm not sure that's true, because I think even however you look at it, your reading of 603 is that at the moment that was passed, there was one budget and there were these federal processes, And what your reading of the statute is in the granting an amendment power, it was changed to optional. All right? That these processes involving the president and the Congress, passive versus active review, total versus fractured budget, those things will be optional.
Well,
because
Honor,
they can be changed later. And you're saying that's what happened when this was passed in 1973. 603 made something optional that wasn't optional before.
Correct? I wouldn't characterize it as making something optional. Congress created an amendment process that in 1973
right.
required Congress's affirmative involvement.
I know, but at that point you were allowed to pass an amendment to get out of it.
That's true, and that happened actually in 1977. Mm-hmm. The first amendment to the district's charter, the Initiative, Referendum, and Recall Act, made changes to the district's budget process that is irreconcilable with the mayor and CFO's understanding of what Section 603A accomplished. Through that referendum, through that charter amendment, which was affirmatively approved by both chambers of Congress, because this was before CHATA, the district created a new power to require the president and Congress to return draft budgets and not to consider them until the people of the District of Columbia had an opportunity to review and revise the capital expenditure budget of the District of Columbia. Now, if one were to assume that Congress, through Section 603A, wanted to say, as it did in Section 602A, the Council shall not do anything in the future, the Council shall have no authority to change the budget process, well, that first charter amendment passed just 4 years later would have been clearly invalid, but nobody has suggested as much. And that's why
but
we
that's
think
that's because it left the roles of the Congress, the President, the OMB, and the Comptroller General. It added in a role for the voters, but it left their roles intact.
No,
here,
it added.
You're pushing the President out of the process.
It added additional responsibilities for the President and to Congress, in particular the responsibility to return the legislation to the D.C. Board of Elections and Ethics.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a change in their role there.
Mm-hmm.
Moreover, with respect to the roles...
Is there any case holding whether that action complied with 603 or not?
There is no case holding, mm-hmm. but it's a strong indication given as to what the understanding of these provisions were shortly after it was passed. And we have the benefit in 1977 of the affirmative approval of both chambers of Congress. And that, I think, suggests a lot about what this amendment process was designed to do. The recall portion of that charter amendment resulted in the voters introducing and Congress approving a package of reforms that Congress had decided not to include in 1973. So this notion that when Congress took things out of the bill, when Congress prevented the district from doing things in 1973, that it was forever shutting the door, well, that is inconsistent with the nature of this amendment process. This amendment
process
was...
How do you reconcile this theory again with... No change is being made to, you're saying, actually, it authorizes changes to be made going forward, so it made things optional. Right? How do you reconcile that? I still don't understand your answer. You've given an example of another law, but I don't understand how that fits with the text of the statute. You changed it from 1973, the day before this was enacted, those federal powers were in concrete, and the day after it was enacted, you're saying 603 didn't mean what it says because those things were no longer in concrete. Those things were subject to change.
Well, Your Honor, I think that's a natural consequence of an interpretive provision. When Congress passes legislation, it has the authority to say, this is what we're doing here. That's why it says nothing in this act shall be construed. Well, what's being construed here? What's being construed is the change being made by this act. So in some sense...
But the change in this act did make a change. It made in the change in existing law.
Well, okay, so perhaps
that's
I'm trying to understand what Your Honor's
question
is. Are you suggesting that the act was changed in 2013 through the...
No, what I'm saying is you have a reading of the amendment power that did change existing law about the roles of the President, Congress, et cetera, in 603.
So our interpretation of the amendment power is that it created the authority for the district to make future proposals as to how the government would mature, how the district would mature, and what the composition of the charter would look like in the future.
Right, but that
we
was a change in existing law.
We don't think that constitutes a change in 1973. The change, the roles of the President, of Congress, of OMB, were not changed by the mere creation of a process under which Congress would continue to supervise the actions of the district and would have the authority to vote yay or nay on proposals that came from the Council.
I don't see how you square. I know you try, I think, rather meekly. in your brief how you square your interpretation of 603A with 602B?
Well, so 602B...
If you concede, you cannot amend.
602B, we don't think can be amended, but 602B has an interesting and significant legislative history behind it, which is that the entities
same
that
language,
are...
That's your problem. Nothing in this chapter shall be construed.
Well, it says nothing in this chapter shall be nothing.
Which you think is powerful in 603, and you dismiss, I think, very weakly with respect to 602.
Well,
I don't have to go to the legislative history. I'm looking at the language.
Oh, I know. And the length, and there's
and these are both within the excluded categories, the 602 provisions.
Yes, and there are two responses to that, Your Honor. The first is that Section 602B doesn't say nothing in this act shall be construed as making any change. It refers to how to construe the power that's being vested in the council. And what the question then is, well, what provision is that this act?
It says nothing in this chapter shall be construed as vesting.
Right. So it's interpreting the authority that's being vested, as opposed to Section 603A, which interprets the changes that are being made by the act. But more significantly, perhaps, is that Section 602B is giving content and interpreting another provision within Section 602. It explains how Section 602A3 should be understood with respect to borderline district federal entities. The National Zoo, shortly before the passage of Home Rule in 1973, was a local zoo. It then had a mixed relationship with the Smithsonian Institution, and there were questions as to whether this would be a federal function. Was the zoo something federal, or was it something local? Same with the Washington Aqueduct. So Section 602B makes sense because it was necessary to specify how Section 602A3, which we agree is a limitation, how that applies with respect to these borderline entities.
But why is it more of a limitation? It uses the same present tense language, vesting right. versus making. And so nothing in this act vested it in D.C., but surely a later amendment could do that, which is the same thing you're saying under 603.
Well, we think there are two possible interpretations of what 602B was doing.
Textually, how do you distinguish the present tense, nothing in this act vesting, and nothing in this act making? How do you distinguish?
Well, right, and I think that the answer to that depends on which of two forks mm-hmm. The interpretive analysis goes down. In our view, the most reasonable interpretation of 602B is it's giving content to 602A3 as these borderline entities. And for those purposes, if the zoo is a borderline entity, this gives content to what is a federal function. Well, that can't be changed. If, however, as you say, we're not interpreting 602A3 and we're in some netherland, then it is possible. There is a reasonable interpretation under which 602B says the exact same thing. That the zoo is right now has certain federal characteristics, but a charter amendment could be passed. The Congress would have an opportunity to vote it up or down, and that could move forward. We think, looking at it, that the 602A3 connection is the most plausible interpretation. But
the council could change its mind.
Excuse me?
The council could change its mind.
Well, no, not under the interpretation
that
it's connected to 602A3. Right.
You would be locked in. It would be an exclusion from the authority to amend.
Right, and that's because these are deemed to be federal functions within the meaning of 602A3.
Well, as is the appropriation process, which, excuse me, 603 freezes in.
Well, Section 603E is
what... If I'm in your shoes, I'm trying to think how I try and argue it, too. You're arguing, I guess, as well as you can, saying in 602 there's a reference back. But in the critical provisions in 602 and 603, they're essentially the same. And if anything, 602, which you can see, doesn't work for you, or putting them together surely does not work for you, because 603 appears to say the appropriation process as we know it, which involves a certain federal involvement, is frozen. You can't amend it. We all know what it is.
Section 603A does not say you cannot amend it. I think that it's meaningful.
It itself doesn't say it, but the exceptions point to 603.
I don't think so. Congress knew full
sure
well how to be clear. Congress knew full well how to be clear when
the
authority...
Wait, now I'm missing. The exceptions refer to the 603 provisions.
Oh, you're referring to Section 303D.
Yeah, yes.
Okay, well, Section 303D doesn't say everything in 601, 602, and 603 is a limitation on the council. It couldn't possibly mean that because 603D, for example, acts only on the mayor. There are some very helpful explanations of this in Professor Estridge's.
But you still couldn't amend it to change the mayor's authority, right?
I think that you could. It would be certain that Congress would vote
that
down.
I'm sorry, so even though 303D says you can't change limitations in 603, you're saying we can pick in and out of 603 what we can amend or not?
Well, Section 303D says that you can't amend as to the limitations on the council. Section 603D does not speak to the council. It speaks to the mayor. So 303D would not prohibit the district from proposing proposing an amendment that you know, somehow interfered with 603D. I mean, the point is more that the language in 303D doesn't foreclose. It doesn't require one to read Section 603A to mean something that it doesn't say. And Congress, you know, had the opportunity. It knew full well how to be clear. And the change in the language that came from the Nelson substitute going to Section 603A, we think, is telling. Congress had before it, or the drafters of Section 603A had before them, language that said, unless specifically authorized or directed by the Congress, there shall be no change made in existing laws. It took that language out and said instead, nothing in this act shall be construed as making any change in existing law. Now, we are supposed to assume that changes of this nature are meaningful, and we're supposed to assume that the differences in linguistic effect, for example, the difference between Section 602A, which says the council shall have no authority, and Section 603A, which says nothing in this act shall be construed as making any change, we're supposed to understand that all of this is meaningful. There's also an instance that's cited in the legislative history and in the brief for members of Congress, where draft legislation was introduced during one of the markup sessions that said, nothing in this act shall be construed to do X, Y, and Z, nor shall the council have any authority to do these same things. So under the ordinary reading of the language in Section 603A, as was understood at the time and consistent with the change that was made from the Nelson substitute to Section 603A, this all points in the direction of Congress not clearly specifying that that such a proposal would be prohibited. And that's all consistent, too, with the nature of the amendment process that existed in 1973. That because this amendment process was designed to empower district voters to take ownership over their government, and because the effect of permitting the district to propose amendments was simply that it would go to Congress for an up or down vote, the D.C. Court of Appeals has a long precedent, a long string of cases explaining that unless Congress has been explicit in prohibiting the council from doing something, that Congress was assumed to have spoken clearly, and that we shouldn't be going through this maze.
Can you address briefly, just because your time is, and it was up, the Anti-Deficiency Act argument, and in particular, what express authorization from Congress you have to spend money out of the general fund?
Yes, Your Honor, and I would, to fight the premise a little bit, I don't see an express authorization requirement that is contained within the Anti-Deficiency Act. The Anti-Deficiency Act imposes two requirements.
What if it's in a lot of case law?
Well, and a lot of the case law, however, is speaking to money that's within the Treasury for which there's this overlay of constitutional obligations. And that overlay, as the mayor and CFO now acknowledge, is not present here.
Now, what if we read that overlay as within congressional control? Whether it's in the Treasury or some other place doesn't really matter to us for purpose of the Anti-Deficiency Act. Well, that, within federal control, and you don't have an express authorization to spend.
Well, let me disagree now with the fact there's no express authorization to spend because Congress created the amendment process. Congress assigned itself a role in the process, and Congress then discharged its role within that process.
But surely we can say, given all of this debate here, textually, there's not an express authorization to spend funds as your own local budget in this statute. We're fighting about textual language. There's nothing express.
I would agree with that because there's a two-step process here. Congress delegated authority to the district, and the district exercised its powers under that delegated authority. That doesn't amount to an express authorization, as you say. But here we're talking about the Congress exercising its district clause authority, not Congress acting under the appropriations clause. And there's a historical parallel that Your Honors may find meaningful, which is that in the 1970s, prior to 1978, I believe, Guam and the U.S. Virgin Islands had a system where under their local governments were funded with money that did not pass through the Treasury. And the Treasury Department took the position then that because that money never went into the Treasury, an appropriation wasn't necessary. And those local governments, which are governed by the same constitutional provision as the District of Columbia, were therefore free to spend their money because it hadn't gone into the Treasury. So here the question is there a lawful basis for the expenditure of money. And if this court agrees that the amendment process was validly followed because Section 603A does not prohibit the district from proposing charter amendments with respect to the budget process, then the Anti-Deficiency Act, which largely speaks to the implementation of the budget as opposed to creating additional requirements for how a budget is to be formulated, that poses no additional obstacle in the analysis here. Now, the mayor and the CFO also invoke Section 603E, and that, I think, is also rather telling, because Section 603E is another provision in the charter that it says nothing in this act shall be construed as altering the applicability of the Anti-Deficiency Act. But they concede on page 51 of their brief that because Section 603E was introduced in the Senate bill when the district was to get budget autonomy, well, that just means that there are multiple ways that one can honor the applicability of the Anti-Deficiency Act. That provision was included because in 1973, the Anti-Deficiency Act didn't mention the D.C. government, and it was necessary to validate and to confirm that the district couldn't spend its money before it had been authorized. So given the mayor and CFO's concession that the Anti-Deficiency Act would have been satisfied under the draft Senate bill, we don't think that Section 603E or anything in the Home Rule Act itself can provide any additional restrictions vis-a-vis the operation of the Anti-Deficiency Act.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the Court, on behalf of D.C. Mayor Vincent Gray and D.C.'s independent CFO Jeff DeWitt and the thousands of D.C. employees put in jeopardy under the Federal Anti-Deficiency Act by the Council's Budget Autonomy Act, I urge the Court to affirm Judge Sullivan's well-reasoned judgment. As he ruled, the Council's Act, which usurps the appropriations power of the Congress for most of the D.C. budget and eliminates the President from that part, is invalid as it violates the congressionally passed Home Rule Act and the Anti-Deficiency Act.
Can you start with standing for us, please?
With respect to standing, I agree that the Council has standing. The Council and the cases that the Court cited, I think, are easily distinguishable. Those are individual legislators who were suing, and they had other remedies to go back to their legislature and get relief. Whereas this is the body that is suing, and it's suing to vindicate its legislative authority and its authority on budgeting, because they acted to increase their authority vis-a-vis the Congress. And that is what divides
the
parties.
So anytime, anywhere in this country, city council and a mayor are fighting about how a law is being implemented, that city council can bring a lawsuit asking a federal court to tell the mayor how to implement the law?
Well, you asked two different questions. First of all, it's not every city, but there are a number of cases around the country where city councils have sued the mayor, including the New York City Council that sued Mayor Bloomberg. And then the second question you ask about going to federal court, I'm not saying they can go to federal court. We're in federal court here because we're dealing with the congressionally passed Home Rule Act, which involves functions of the federal government as well as of the local government. And the provisions, like in the Thomas against
Barrett
case.
Well, let's stick with D.C. Every time the city council doesn't like how the mayor is administering a duly enacted law, they can bring a lawsuit?
No.
They have standing. I don't have my merits. No. I don't want to talk about whether it arises under federal law. They would have standing under Article 3 to say we're injured by your maladministration.
No, it's not. I don't accept that. That's not what this case is about. This case is about the power of the legislature, the D.C. Council, to pass legislation to aggrandize its own position with respect to the budget.
It passed the legislation. That authority wasn't apparent, so there's no injury there.
No, but they passed it, but it requires operation of the mayor and the CFO to participate with them in order to effectuate
that. That's how laws are. They get passed by legislatures, and then it requires the executive branch to do some things to put it into action.
And when there's a dispute which relates to the interpretation of a federal law, which is what divides the party, and it's a valid dispute, I think the federal court is the right place to bring that, and the council has standing to assert that. So
and
on that issue,
tell me what the injury is again. I'm not understanding. If the injury is
is to their legislative authority, because they have passed a statute which, as I say, takes away the powers from the Congress and gives it to them, also takes away powers from the president, and they say this has to be enforced. And the mayor is saying the federal law prohibits me, both the Anti-Deficiency Act and the Home Rule Act, prohibit me from doing this. If I were to do this, I would subject myself to liability, and therefore there is an impasse. And in addition to the council having standing, certainly the mayor has standing on the counterclaim that we brought.
Well,
and
that's
which is
not going to work, because a counterclaim can't create standing in an action that doesn't already exist. The counterclaim has to take the complaint as it finds it, and if there's no jurisdiction over that complaint because there's no standing, counterclaim can't create it.
I don't read the cases the same way. I understand that if the complaint was dismissed but the counterclaim, which was filed before that happened, that would establish standing for the court to have a case or controversy.
What case is that? Because I'm aware of cases where even an intervener who files a complaint can't create standing in an action in which there's no standing. So what case is it that says a counterclaim?
I'll stand on our brief in this regard, Your Honor. I would like to get to the merits of this case, because I think it's really critical that this be decided by this court on the merits, and that Judge Sullivan's case decision be affirmed. There are three separate, independent, but intertwined provisions of the Home Rule Act that preclude the Budget Autonomy Act. Section 303D says that the council may not amend the charter in violation of any of the limitations in 601, 602, and 603 of the Act. You talked about 603A, so let me go to that as the
first. Can you go back and tell me why Diamond doesn't control here for arising under jurisdiction?
I don't see Diamond as involved at all in this. The first place, the Thomas against Barry case, which preceded Diamond, made it clear that when there are federal functions involving under the Home Rule Act, that the federal courts have jurisdiction to decide the respective division of responsibilities under the Home Rule Act, the federal statute, between the federal government and the local government. And they said it's a hybrid statute. Where the matters are only local, then there's not jurisdiction. But when it involves the federal functions, then there is federal
Diamond
jurisdiction.
Diamond involved taking power away from the federal courts.
I don't agree with that. In the Diamond case, the Diamond case was a statute. It was a no-fault insurance statute that said that if there's not $5,000 of medical expenses, you can't go to court to claim your non-economic damages. In a matter where there's only $5,000 involved, the matter was going to be in the local courts. It was not going to get to federal district court if it only had $5,000 or less with respect to medical damages. So there were two issues in Diamond.
Why was that? One, there was a law that said it couldn't go to federal court already?
There's a federal law that said it couldn't come to
federal
court with $5,000?
There were jurisdictional amounts. Diversity matters had to be in excess of $10,000 at the time. Now it's at $50,000 or $75,000. And federal question jurisdiction had amounts, minimum amounts. So, and there wasn't going to be a federal question jurisdiction. So it was going to affect, there were two grounds in Diamond. One was that the council didn't take two votes on the matter, which is clearly a local matter, having nothing to do with the federal government. And the second was, it said, it might interfere with the jurisdiction of the courts, and when focused on the courts, it focused on the local courts. It focused on the superior court. There's really not a word about the federal court in that decision. And so I think that decision was correctly decided. But, you know, since that time, we've had further cases. We have the Bliley case, which, again, involves the Home Rule Act and the role of Congress in it. And the court said we have federal jurisdiction. And then we have the Bender against Jordan case, which says that where the matter is going to be resolved on the basis of federal law, that is a federal question and belongs in federal court.
Didn't the Supreme Court in Diamond say that a state has standing to defend the constitutionality of its statute?
I'm sorry?
Didn't the Supreme Court in Diamond say that, it may be dictative, but they certainly said it, that a state has standing to defend the constitutionality of its statute? thought the court was essentially agreeing with the point you're making.
The Diamond case is from this court. Isn't that right? I don't know that we have a Supreme Court decision.
Maybe Charles.
Karcher versus May said that, but I think that from the Supreme Court said that. But it said that when state law authorizes the legislature to take on that role, which doesn't happen here, right? D.C. law authorizes the Attorney General, not the counsel, to handle litigation.
That is correct. But if I can get back to the merits of this matter, because I think clearly there is jurisdiction here. Jordan against Bender makes it clear. Bliley makes it clear. Thomas against Barry makes that clear. And I also believe there is a standing, as both counsel and we agree. 603A is clearly a prohibition on an amendment to the charter. It's important to see where the Congress put this. It's also important to understand the history of the Diggs Amendment, which is the compromise that without which
how do you distinguish the Recall Act that your friend discussed?
I'm sorry?
How do you distinguish the Recall Act that your friend discussed? Did that violate 603 or not?
I don't think it violated 603 at all. That's a provision that deals with initiative and referendum, and it specifically excluded appropriations from being a matter that the voters could vote on. And this is precisely why, and that's what's explained in the Hesse case in the Court of Appeals, that it's recognized that from the beginning, Congress insisted on having complete power of the purse over the budget. That was the compromise that was reached. And it was reflected in two provisions. One is in 446, which lays out the procedure and preserves the role of the Congress. And the second, which is clearly not surplusage, which is 603A, which was put in the title, which says matters reserved to the Congress. Then under limitations of the council in 602, and as the court noted, 602B has the same language, nothing shall be construed, which the legislative history before 603A existed said was a prohibition. Then they decided to put it in a section, 603, which at the time was entitled Limitations on Borrowing and Spending. So it was put into a section called Limitations, and it was given the same prefatory language of nothing shall be construed, as, by the way, is 603E, which says nothing shall be construed to allow the district to violate the Anti-Deficiency Act. In each of those provisions, 602B, 603A, and 603E, there is legislative history that says this was intended as a limitation, as a restriction, as a prohibition on the council. In 602B, it was in the committee report, the House committee report, as the bill was passed out before the Diggs Amendment.
I don't know why we need the legislative history. I mean, 303D calls it a limitation. Why isn't that enough?
Exactly. It is a limitation. That is exactly what it demonstrates.
But then they say, when I say that, they say, well, not everything in 603 is a limitation.
Well, I haven't read everything in 603, and I agree that not everything in there could be a limitation, but 603A is intended as a limitation, and its language makes that clear. This is the same language that Justice Brennan in the Louisiana Public Commission case said was a substantive limitation and which this court adopted in the FCC case that we cite. So that by any stretch, by the plain language of the statute as well as the legislative history, 603A is a limitation. In addition, we have 602A3, which says you can't interfere, the council cannot enact a law that affects a function of the United States. For 140 years, it has been a function of the Congress and the President to do the appropriations for the D.C. budget. And by the way, you're exactly right, Your Honor, that it talks about the total budget. That is what is in 603A. It talks about the total budget and says you can't make any change in the total budget of the District of Columbia. You can't divide it up into these parts. And so for 140 years, the Congress has been doing the appropriations for the district And the notion that it is not a function is just, it's just impossible to comprehend.
Well, I think what they would say is it's a function that's purely local. It's passing a local budget. It's not a national function.
Well, but the statute does not say a national function. It says a function of the United States. And it has been, and of course, under the Constitution, the Congress has exclusive and plenary control over the District of Columbia.
Right, but that can't be our test, because then everything in D.C., you know, parking tickets, to littering rules, to slip and fall torts, were historically a function of Congress, and they're in as plenary control. But function has to have some limitation.
No, but it's not, I don't accept that. The function is what is carried out by the United States government. And appropriations have been carried out by the Congress and the President for 140 years, and that includes the 40 years after 1973. With respect to local matters of parking, other things, that's exactly what the tech world says, that says that the Congress delegated that to the District of Columbia, and it's been doing that for 50 years, closing streets in the District of Columbia. That's a local function. Absolutely, that's a local function. But appropriations is a function of the United States, without which the Home Rule Act would never have been passed. That is the critical point. This would never have occurred if Congress had not retained the power of the purse and put it off limits to the district government to change their ability to do that. I also, and we need to talk about the Anti-Deficiency Act, which is not only prescribed in 603E as not the district not being allowed to violate the Anti-Deficiency Act, but it exists independently of the Home Rule Act, and it definitely, absolutely requires express authority by the Congress to allow anyone involving federal money to spend the money without an authorization, a specific express authorization from the Congress. And that's the decision by this court. I mean, there are many cases, Supreme Court cases, that say that, but the Nevada case in this court makes that clear, that there were funds there that were not tax money, that was not money that came into the Treasury Department. It was money that was collected by the local authority from the generators of waste, nuclear waste, and they were not allowed to spend a dime of that because they did not have an appropriations from the Congress. And so that this action by the council violates independently, it violates the Anti-Deficiency Act, and therefore is preempted and is unlawful. And, as I mentioned at the outset, puts in jeopardy the mayor, the independent CFO, and any employee of the District of Columbia who spends a dime under the council's appropriation of funds when the Congress hasn't authorized that. Let me conclude by saying that there hasn't been a word here about the GAO. The GAO is the expert, the federal agency that is expert with respect to the Anti-Deficiency Act and with respect to appropriations. They have weighed in at the request of the chairman of the relevant committee in Congress and said that this act is a nullity and that it violates the Anti-Deficiency Act and violates the Home Rule Act. The judge, Judge Sullivan, was quite appropriate in relying on that, in giving deference. It's not dispositive, but it needs to be considered and given the weight that an expert opinion is due, and there's no other expert opinion in the record here. I also asked the court to, the judge below said, the law is clear, the legislative history is clear, and common sense is clear. Think about this. What they are saying is that from 1973 until today, they've had the power to change this law. The notion is this law would not have passed but for the agreement by the Diggs and the proponents of Home Rule to retain with the Congress the power of the purse. And yet they're saying the day that the ink was dried on President Nixon's signature, the council could come back and change that. That is just unbelievable. That cannot possibly be the case. That would not have gotten the support of the Natchers and the others who were opposed to giving up the power of the purse. And then consider this. For 40 years since that act was passed, the council has abided by this system, and we've had these appropriations repeatedly. And the member from the district, Congressman Fauntroy, who was on this Diggs Amendment, 10 years after this passed, proposed legislation that the Congress change and grant the district budget autonomy, which, by the way, we all share that view, that that's what should happen here, that Congress should grant budget autonomy. It is appropriate. We agree with that. But if the council had the power to do that, why would they go to Congress? And not only that one time, every year since that time, they've gone to Congress and asked Congress to change and give them budget autonomy. If they had it with respect to, and by the way, those requests by Fauntroy and mayors and members of the city council to the Congress predated the 1984 change and postdated the 1984 change. Well, 1984 change, of course, is 30 years ago. If they had the power, there's no way they would be going to Congress and urging the Congress to pass this legislation. So the record that we have here of 40 years of compliance with the Home Rule Act, having appropriations by the Congress with a role by the President in the D.C. budget, has been the understanding and the performance by the D.C. government and the Congress, and that continues to be certainly the understanding of the Congress, and it certainly continues to be the understanding of the mayor and of the CFO. I urge the court to affirm Judge Sullivan's decision and to allow them to get back to the budget as it's required in 446, and also to allow our new delegate and the others to return to Congress and make the valid case there for budget autonomy, which we fully support. Thank you very much.
So clear we were passing in the night on Diamond v. Charles' Supreme Court case.
Oh, I see.
476 U.S. 54, where the court just says in passing, like it's clear as day, that a state has standing to defend its own statute. INS v. Chadha says essentially the same thing. There's a Wyoming v. Oklahoma case that two states fighting, but again, the courts seem to distinguish those cases because they involve a legislative or state entity acting in a way to protect the interest that they have, as opposed to the legislative cases where they're individuals.
I share that view completely. I'm sorry, I confused, but the judge was asking me about the Diamond case.
That was my confusion. I'm not telling you it's a different right. Diamond that I have
yeah.
in mind.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Netter, I know you were far over your time, but that was our fault, so we'll give you back 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. On jurisdiction, the Attorney General said that this has to be a federal question because the Home Rule Act was passed by Congress. That can't possibly be the standard under Section 1366, because Section 1366 was passed in 1970, before the Home Rule Act, when everything that governed the District of Columbia was passed by Congress. Also, he referenced the Blagley case as an indication for why this court has jurisdiction, because the court had jurisdiction in Blagley, but Blagley was filed by a member of Congress under Section 1983. The court didn't have to address Section 1366 in the context of that case. On the merits, a theme of the Attorney General's argument is that the council has somehow set out to usurp the power of Congress and the President. Nothing could be further from the truth. Congress retains its authority to appropriate money for the district, to overrule the council's determination of what its budget should be. Congress could repeal the Budget Autonomy Act, or Congress could repeal the Home Rule Act. Congress has plenary authority here, and the President retains his authority to make recommendations to the Congress. So this suggestion that somehow the council has taken something away from Congress is simply not the case. Instead, Congress created this system. It created a system in which it was delegating authority to the local government with the understanding that Congress would retain its supervisory powers. After 11 years after Chadha, Congress decided to take a significant step in granting greater authority. But it doesn't mean that Congress no longer has control and can't decide what to do. That, I think, in large part is why the D.C. Court of Appeals has taken a very strong view as to how one should interpret the Home Rule Act. It would be very difficult, of course, if this court were to adopt a different interpretive standing, a different interpretive standard. And the D.C. Court of Appeals has taken the view that unless Congress was specific, unless Congress specifically indicated limitations on the Council's authority, then it should be Congress's prerogative to overrule the district and not that of the court system. Here, all of the discussions of how the budget process could be impermissible result in some roundabout interpretation of seven different provisions of the statute, whereas we know that Congress knew full well in 1973 how to be explicit. The Attorney General says that Congress was very focused on this issue and says that Section 603A is an indication that Congress was explicitly prohibiting future amendments to the Charter. But that's simply not what Section 603A says, particularly when 603A is compared to 602A and Section 603C. What we know is that Congress had before it, or at least the House had before it with the Nelson substitute, language that would have been explicit, language that would very specifically have told the district what it could not do in the future. Congress did not accept that language. It chose a much different course that explained what Congress was doing in 1973. And because the Council's current action and the action of the people of the district does not implicate Section 603A, the Budget Autonomy Act is lawful, and we therefore ask this court either to vacate or reverse the judgment below. Thank you.
Thank you. Case will be submitted.